And our sermon text today is Job chapters 25 through 27. As we find ourselves in the midst of round three of Job's friends, and it's Bildad today. Mary, Queen of Scots, came to the throne of Scotland in 1561 when the Reformation was in full surge in the British Isles. She was determined to restore the Roman Catholic faith to the islands. John Knox was determined to oppose her. He preached several daring sermons opposing her rule and efforts to reinstate the Roman Catholic Mass into Scotland. She found abominable. So, Mary requested an interview with Knox, to seek to charm and persuade him otherwise, to co-opt him. She had a reputation for being both ruthless and charming and persuasive. I doubt not that Reverend Knox will come under the spell of her blandishments, one of her ministers quipped before the interview. But Mary did not count on the character of God's firebrand, as Knox came to be known. And at one point in the interview, she asked Knox, "Think you that subjects having power may resist their princes?" And Knox answered, "If their princes exceed their bounds, madam, no doubt they may be resisted even by power. For there is neither greater honor or greater obedience to be given to kings or princes that God has commanded to be given unto father or mother. But the father may be stricken with a frenzy in which he would slay his children. If the children arise, join themselves together, take the sword from him, bind his hands, and keep him in prison till his frenzy be overpast. Think you, madam, that the children do any wrong? It is even so, madam, with princes that would murder the children of God that are subjects unto them. Their blind zeal is nothing but a very mad frenzy. And therefore, to take the sword from them, to bind their hands and to cast them into prison till they be brought to a more sober mind is no disobedience against princes, but just obedience because it agrees with God." The account goes on to say, at these words, the queen stood as it were amazed. More than a quarter of an hour, her countenance altered, so that Lord James began to entreat her and demand, "What hath offended you, madam?" Stunned into silence, this once breezy charmer could muster no charm or persuasive arguments to counter Knox. All the court were shocked and amazed. Who had ever seen her without a clever answer in response? Well, that didn't stay her for long, because she sent Knox away as a galley slave not long afterwards. But Job does much the same thing to his three friends that Knox did to Mary, Queen of Scots. Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar, these three friends of Knox, he stuns them into silence such that they are speechless. They are no longer able to answer Job after today. And our narrative indicates this to us in several ways. So let's look to our text today. Point number one, first of all, you have an outline in the overflap of your bulletin, your inside flap, excuse me. Round three, in a Bildad. In a final floundering flourish, Bildad weakly asserts the power and transcendence of God. You've been tracking with us. You've seen all three of these guys take their shots, right, at Job. And this is the very last sputtering one, a final floundering flourish by Bildad. Chapter 25. Once again, put your eyes in the text and your ears on me. Chapter 25, verses 1 through 6. Then Bildad the Shuhite answered and said, "Dominion and fear are with God. He makes peace in his high heaven. Is there any number to his armies? Upon whom does his light not arise? How then can man be in the right before God? How can he who is born of woman be pure? Behold, even the moon is not bright, and the stars are not pure in his eyes. How much less man who is a maggot, and the son of man who is a worm?" Job 25 is the shortest chapter in the book because Bildad is short on power, persuasion, and passion. While Eliphaz last week delivered a sustained, coherent argument, which was his last shot, Job nevertheless easily parried it, didn't he? And today, Bildad meekly throws up an empty cliche. We've just heard this argument so often. And he does it as a last desperate Hail Mary type of pass into the end zone. And Job intercepts it, if you will, and returns it for a touchdown, if I can extend that metaphor a little bit. Zophar, where is Zophar? Huh? Our third interlocutor. Zophar is so intimidated that he doesn't even come out of the locker room to play in this last round. He takes two shots at Job, while Bildad and Eliphaz take three. And in the narrative, that says something, doesn't it? But Bildad does give it one last shot here. And we have seen this argument of his in almost every speech of the three amigos. That is the argument from God's transcendent greatness and man's own small creatureliness. Eliphaz had done it in his last speech. And Job, once again, we'll see, does not resist the premise of this argument at all. In fact, he will take it up and far surpass Bildad in his own wisdom and insight. Job is just getting started. But with man's own intrinsic corruption, Bildad all but calls Job a worm and a maggot. We've seen how this is done, right? "Behold, even the moon is not bright, and the stars are not pure in his eyes. How much less a man who is a maggot, and the son of man who is a worm," i.e. you, Job. And so, the last words of Job's friends contrast starkly from the first words to Job of Job's friends, Eliphaz. Eliphaz says this right out of the gate when he begins with Job. He says, "Behold, you've instructed many. You've strengthened the weak hands. Your words have upheld him who was stumbling. And you have made firm the feeble knees." That's how they start out with Job, right? Now, they're reduced to name calling as they fall into silence. "Job, you maggot! You worm!" And so, the testimony for the prosecution has been heard. Final words. Remember in your outline, and Stuart distributed one here a couple of weeks ago, you find that we are in that section of the patriarchal lawsuit that takes further testimony from prosecution witnesses. And that's what the length of this book has been. Now we're still in it. Job is responding. The defense is responding, and we're going to see his eloquence here in weeks to come. But these three unwitting witnesses for the prosecution have spent their strength. Satan has tried his best to demonstrate through Job's three friends that Job does not fear God for naught. And through them, through these friends, he has attempted to persuade Job as well, right? To deny his integrity. That was one of the major thrusts all through the taking of further testimony by these prosecutorial witnesses. Get Job to deny his integrity, which God has confessed to. And if God has confessed the integrity of Job and Job denies it, what does that say about the Word of God? So through these guys, he's attempted to persuade Job to deny his integrity, to admit that he is not blameless and upright, fearing God and turning away from evil. But Job has held fast. And Job will soon eloquently restate that which God has testified concerning him. God has last testified about him back in chapter 2. Have you, that is Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on earth, a blameless and upright man who fears God and turns away from evil? He still holds fast his integrity. That's in chapter 2. And he still does here now too, doesn't he? Although you incited me against him to destroy him without reason. If Job had denied his integrity, confessed sin, then he would have denied God's word. What would we say about God's understanding and wisdom and omniscience, all those attributes of God that enable this statement about him, about Job? So, these guys sputter to a stop like a bad carburetor, don't they? But first, Job will take up Bildad's theme before he confesses his own integrity and restates it. First, he will take up Bildad's theme and expand upon it. That brings us to point two. Round three. We are concluding round three of the testimony from the prosecutorial witnesses. Round three. And Bildad is in the docket. In a final triumphant flourish, Job strongly asserts the power and transcendence of God. Chapter 26. In a final triumphant flourish, Job strongly asserts the power and transcendence of God, unlike Bildad was able to do. So let's look to chapter 26, verses 1 to 14. Then Job answered and said, "How you have helped him who has no power. How you have saved the arm that has no strength. How you have counseled him who has no wisdom and plentifully declared sound knowledge. With whose help have you uttered words? And whose breath has come out from you? The dead tremble under the waters and their inhabitants. Sheol is naked before God, and Abaddon has no covering. He stretches out the north over the void and hangs the earth on nothing. He binds up the waters in his thick clouds, and the cloud is not split open under them. He covers the face of the full moon and spreads over it his cloud. He has inscribed a circle on the face of the waters at the boundary between light and darkness. The pillars of heaven tremble and are astounded at his rebuke. By his power he stilled the sea. By his understanding he shattered Rahab. By his wind the heavens were made fair. His hand pierced the fleeing serpent. Behold, these are but the outskirts of his ways. And how small a whisper do we hear of him. But the thunder of his power, who can understand?" Job begins by, as is his wont, by giving no great thanks to his friends for their input. And this drips of sarcasm. You want an example of pure sarcasm? Just highlight these verses. "How you have helped him who has no power. How you have saved the arm that has no strength." And there's an irony here because, of course, Job is physically emaciated, physically weak, but he has been rolling thunder, hasn't he, spiritually? Gaining strength and momentum and power. "How you have counseled him who has no wisdom and plentifully declared sound knowledge." They, of course, have sputtered to a stop like a bad carburetor. But him, his wisdom has expanded exponentially. And his sound knowledge has as well, has it not? And it's just going to gain strength, momentum, power, so forth in the chapters to come. Job also alludes to the chief prosecutor they have unwittingly served. "With whose help have you uttered words? And whose breath has come out from you?" In Job's survey of creation, as you keep your eyes in the text, In Job's survey of creation, he begins with the underworld and its inhabitants. The dead tremble under the waters and their inhabitants. The dead. That Hebrew word there is Rephaim. Now we encounter the Rephaim oftentimes in the Old Testament, the Psalms, the prophets, and most illustrative in Genesis, the supernatural humans they are. The supernatural humans from Genesis who were the product of the mating of the sons of God with the daughters of men. Back in Genesis. The Rephaim, who are captive there now, tremble under the waters and their inhabitants. And then, in the ancient three-tiered universe, the realm of the dead and demonic was under the earth, buried beneath the seas also representing chaos and destruction, tohu vabohu, remember from Genesis? These seas, however, stilled and brought to order by God at creation. And that realm is named, too, Sheol, the realm of the dead, broadly, and then Abaddon, more narrowly, that aspect of Sheol which signifies destruction. In Greek, the word is Apollyon, which will figure largely in Revelation, but has its roots and forebearer here in the Old Testament. So before you go running with your Revelation, Red Heifer, Rapture stuff from Revelation, the book of Revelation, read this first, okay? Please. You modern dispensationalists have no clue what's going on with Abaddon, Apollyon, for example, in Revelation 9. They have as a king over them the angel of the bottomless pit. His name in Hebrew is Abaddon. And in Greek, he is called Apollyon. John knows this intimately from the Old Testament. And he is basing his understanding here in places like Job, not consulting Hal Lindsey or John Darby or whoever dispensationalist you might want to pick. He didn't have the advantage of the Left Behind series, Job. Anyway, in ancient cosmologies, the underworld was largely left to itself in chaotic misery, full of death and destruction, with no order or orderer. This needs to be understood. Job, however, is here insisting that, au contraire, God is ultimately keeper here as well. There's no square inch of creation over which he does not preside and is not sovereign. Job then sketches the remainder of creation, the other two realms, heaven and earth. He stretches out the north. It's been really interesting studying the Hebrew of Job here because they translate this word Zaphon, which in the Hebrew, as north. But I just scratched my head when I came across this. It doesn't say north, it says Zaphon. And Zaphon was the mountain of the gods in ancient cosmology, which extended into the heavens and represents the heavens. He stretches out the north and hangs the earth on nothing. The idea of stretching and hanging is creation language. This is God creating then all realms, the realm beneath, the realm above, and the earth. Those waters above the earth, thick clouds, the waters under the earth, a circle on the face of the waters. Interesting expression. A circle on the face of the waters. It's just an eloquent and very poetic expression, isn't it? But the idea of drawing a circle on a thing is to give boundaries to it. Within those boundaries is order and calm and peace. So the waters above the earth and under the earth are all well ordered and accounted for by God. And the mountains were characterized as the pillars of heaven. The mountains were characterized as the pillars of heaven, stable, unshakable, steady, yet God causes them to tremble and be astounded. Great anthropomorphism, right? The idea of attributing human qualities to inanimate things. And then in a direct reference to chaos and destruction, Job asserts God's power over the beast from the sea, Rahab. We encountered Rahab in Isaiah, didn't we, today? And once again, beast from the sea, Rahab. Where else do we encounter a beast from the sea? Revelation, right? Just before the rapture? Just after the rapture? No! Consult what's happening here in the Old Testament before you go running off to read half of a rapture. Left behind imaginations in the book of Revelation. So, Job asserts God's power over the beast from the sea, which is Rahab, which is what John is referring to when he talks about the beast from the sea in the book of Revelation. The serpent, the devil, as he would become also a metaphor for Egypt too, as it was in the book of Isaiah. The idea of opening up the sea, slicing up Rahab first, right? That was the destruction of Pharaoh and his armies. There's always been a beastly nation. Always been a beastly nation. A beastly nation is not first occur in the book of Revelation, right? Beastly nations existed. All of those nations that opposed Israel, especially Egypt and Assyria and Babylon, all had beast figures. And John in Revelation is appropriating that very image, which he knew his people would understand, which we don't seem to understand, as beastly nations, not necessarily one beastly man. Okay? So, the beast from the sea, then, is not something new to Revelation. There's such in every period of biblical revelation. And to all of this, God has brought peace, order, and harmony. And the limited understanding that we have of God, he says, behold, I love this expression. Behold, these are but the outskirts of his ways. When Jonah goes into Assyria, he approaches from the outskirts, the same word as we have here. The limited understanding we have of God should give us pause then in attributing purposes to him, that is you guys, the three amigos. Perhaps God has other purposes and reasons for his big wide world than we first imagined. Job knows this now in his gut, doesn't he? From top to bottom to his toenails, he knows this. Unlike his three friends. Well, he then moves on to assert his own integrity here, and that brings us to point three, chapter 27. And point three, round three, Bildad, in a final triumphant flourish, Job strongly asserts his own integrity and covenant faithfulness. Chapter 27. So let's look then at verses 1 through 6 of chapter 27. And Job again took up his discourse and said, as God lives, who has taken away my right, and the Almighty, who has made my soul bitter, as long as my breath is in me and the Spirit of God is in my nostrils, my lips will not speak falsehood. My tongue will not utter deceit. Far be it from me to say that you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me. I hold fast my righteousness and will not let it go. My heart does not reproach me for any of my days. Now, Job is he's just getting started. He's just getting wound up, as I mentioned earlier. And he's about to launch into a series of discourses. And as such, he's going to display wisdom. Now, we've been hungering for true biblical wisdom all through the book of Job, and Job is finally now going to give it to us. And so he swears by God to tell the truth. My lips will not speak falsehood, and my tongue will not utter deceit. And here he promises to do so, that is, maintain his integrity, despite God having taken away my right and making my soul bitter. These are parenthetical remarks, but they serve in contrast to any other man would not maintain his integrity. Job determines to. Job is serving God for naught, if you will. This is Job's way of saying that he will maintain his faith in and fear of God despite his perceived mistreatment by God. So, in that truth, he asserts as strongly and plainly as he ever has, "Far be it from me to say that you are right. Till I die, I will not put away my integrity from me." And in this, he is holding out for what God has said about him. So he is holding out strongly for God's word, for God's declaration of him and about him. He is God's champion. We've said that many times. He is in a trial by ordeal. And he, in that trial by ordeal, which was rife in the ancient world, all would have understood intuitively what he was talking about here, that he is indeed God's champion and championing the word of God, virtually. Job will not confess to sin he has not committed. Job will not repent of things he has not done. Seeing the madness that's going on college campuses today with Antifa and the craziness, it reminds me during the Cultural Revolution under Chairman Mao in China. During the 60s, the Red Guard, tip of the spear in the Cultural Revolution, the Red Guard, composed of university students recruited to be the advance guard of the revolution. Well, during these days, the cadres were cells of students who lived together and coordinated the social justice activities like demonstrations and protests and so on and so forth. Well, these cadres would have truth sessions every day where they would confess in a group before everybody and a party official. They would confess impure thoughts or actions that they took against the revolution that day. No matter how small or insignificant it may have been, they were encouraged to get it out. It was cleansing, cathartic. It was good for the revolution. Many would weep in remorse as they did so, some even throwing themselves on the floor and writhing in despair. It became expected of you. The social justice warrior who didn't confess was suspect. What is he holding back? Does he think he's so pure a revolutionary as the father? That was the name they gave to Chairman Mao. And as a consequence, many of these social justice warriors made things up. They might have said or did. To such a fever pitch was this cultural revolution in China. Well, Job refuses to be a social justice warrior of Lex Talionis, the law of retribution. He refuses to be a revolutionary Red Guard for the Three Amigos. Instead, he says, "I hold fast my righteousness and I will not let it go. I'm not going to confess sin I didn't commit to you guys just to get you off my back and to get God back on the program. My heart does not reproach me for any of my days. I have a clear conscience in all I've done. I have been covenantally faithful to God." To let go his righteousness and reproach himself for what he's done days past would be to surrender his integrity, to lie about what he has done and lie about what God has said about him. It would indeed be game over, wouldn't it? Satan would have triumphed. Because that's exactly what he was maintaining about Job, right? That he serves God for what he can get. And to get it back, he'll do anything, even confess sin and deny his integrity. Well, that's not game over, is it? And Job goes on. Chapter 27, 7 to 12. Let my enemy be as the wicked, and let him who rises up against me be as the unrighteous. For what is the hope of the godless when God cuts him off, when God takes away his life? Will God hear his cry when distress comes upon him? Will he take delight in the Almighty? Will he call upon God at all times? I will teach you concerning the hand of God. What is with the Almighty, I will not conceal. Behold, all of you have seen it yourselves. Why then have you become altogether vain? Job, now before he moves on, curses his accusers. Pretty strong stuff. Makes some commentators blanch a little bit. They rearrange some of these paragraphs. Some of these paragraphs they'll put in the mouth of Bildad because they scratch. But if they don't understand the patriarchal lawsuit, they aren't going to understand this, are they? Understanding Job in the framework of the patriarchal lawsuit, where Job is now under a trial by ordeal, a tool of the lawsuit, you begin to understand why now he turns and makes these accusations against them, the prosecutorial witnesses. As witnesses for the prosecution, these guys, consider this. We have seen this develop all through the book of Job. As witnesses for the prosecution, being so stubborn and not repenting themselves and taking Job at his word, these three amigos have proven themselves to be on the side of the wicked, even if in an unwitting fashion. They have been witnesses for Satan, even if it's unwitting, which is being charitable to them. But the same thing happened in Jesus' day, didn't it? Job is a type of Christ. When the righteous of Jesus' day, the Pharisees, were revealed when Christ appeared to be dark and wicked at heart. But that was revealed only in the light and righteousness of Christ. Not until Christ appeared on the scene did you see that precipitation of these guys out of the righteous, right? Only when Christ appeared did these seemingly righteous, in the light of true righteousness, be revealed for who they were. Same thing is happening to these three guys. Righteous wise men, they came on the scene. By now, they are identified with the wicked. Job is making sure of that. And Job then warns his friends, taking the offensive. Now, there is a grace in this as well. He's being truthful and harsh, perhaps, but he's also being gracious, warning his friends. Later, he will intercede for them, sacrifice on their behalf that they might be forgiven, right, in the last chapter. Job now warns his friends, taking the offensive under a full head of steam. What is the hope of the godless when God cuts him off, when God takes away his life? I.e., this is going to happen to you guys. If not immediately, eventually. Will God hear his cry when distress comes upon him? Will he take delight in the Almighty? Will he call upon God at all times? I hope you're beginning to see the texture of Job now, too. That it's all just not monovocal, right? One dull, boring voice all the way through. There is texture to Job. Because now, with the confidence of a called prophet of God. And remember, too, during this period, the patriarchal period, the patriarchs were incorporated all three offices, prophet, priest, and king, in their day. Later, the advent of Israel, those would all distinguish, were they not? But here in the patriarchal period, the patriarchs were prophets, priests, and kings. So with the confidence of a called prophet of God, Job advises them to take his salutary instruction. The tables have turned, guys. Look at you. You're speechless. Let me teach you now. I will teach you concerning the hand of God. What is with the Almighty, I will not conceal. This is for chapters hence as well, not only this one. Behold, all of you have seen it yourselves. Why then have you become altogether vain? This is them. The roles have been fully, irrevocably reversed. Job now speaks as if he is speaking to wicked men, even as they assumed they were doing at first with him, right? Tables have been fully turned. I want you to see the conviction and the confidence now which possesses Job. You know, remember how tentative he was at first? Speeches were short, tentative, and not full of the kind of verve and bombast, if you will, that they have now. He's just getting rolling. And he's anticipating, foreshadowing the appearance of Elihu, and that Elihu is foreshadowing the appearance of God himself. We're just ramping up the drama. You like biblical drama? You got it underway here in the book of Job, till the appearance of God. So we are now achieving increasing clarity as we move closer and closer to Job's encounter with God. That brings us then to verses 13 to 23. This is the portion of a wicked man with God and the heritage that oppressors receive from the Almighty. If his children are multiplied, it is for the sword, and his descendants have not enough bread. Those who survive him, the pestilence buries, and his widows do not weep. Though he heap up silver like dust and pile up clothing like clay, he may pile it up, but the righteous will wear it, and the innocent will divide the silver. He builds his house like a moth, like a booth that a watchman makes. He goes to bed rich, but will do so no more. He opens his eyes, and his wealth is gone. Terrors overtake him like a flood. In the night, a whirlwind carries him off. The east wind lifts him up, and he is gone. It sweeps him out of his place. It hurls at him without pity. He flees from its power in headlong flight. It claps its hands at him and hisses at him from its place. Job now characterizes the ultimate fate of the wicked, and he's done this to some extent all through the book. His friends have been saying, no, it's one for one. You get exactly what you deserve here in this life, which is why your wickedness must be so egregious, because look at your suffering. But Job has always characterized the ultimate fate of the wicked. Sometimes, indeed, consequences here, but always full and perfect justice in the hereafter. Job now characterizes the ultimate fate of the wicked in some of the very same language, though, that his friends used. But Job does it without fear of being contradicted and without fear of being confused with the wicked any longer. Right? Some commentators say, you know, I don't understand this. Job, doesn't he see the irony in this? Doesn't Job realize the irony of his situation? Isn't he condemning himself from his own mouth? No. He's already established that he's not corporate with the wicked. And he does all of this despite the irony, again, of things that fell upon him, right? If his children are multiplied, it's for the sword. He lost all his kids. He builds his house like a moth. He goes to bed rich. He opens his eyes. Wealth is gone. That happened to him. Terrors overtake him. That's the very phrase he used several times. Terrors have overtaken me. Terrors overtake him like a flood. It hurls at him without pity. It claps its hand at him and hisses at him from its place. That's exactly what has been happening to Job, hasn't it? But he has no fear of being contradicted now. He has established that he is not corporate with the wicked. And this fearlessness of contradiction arises because Job is now confident that he does suffer for a reason and a purpose, but it's unrevealed. Right? That's one of our major points we have been making about human suffering, is that there is human suffering, the purpose and reason for which is unrevealed to the sufferer and those around him. And that brings, as you minister to those who suffer, you bring that principle to them and humanize it and bring it home in a way that personalizes it. And it is a great comfort to humans who suffer. If it just remains an abstract concept to you, forget it. It's just, baseball game at 1 o'clock. Yeah, no, there is real ministry for those who suffer in Job. Job is now confident that he suffers for a reason and a purpose unrevealed to him at the present, and he does not suffer for wicked behavior. He knows this to his toenails now. And that is why he can so confidently warn his friends and enemies of their impending doom in his discourse, and why the tables have turned. But Job also knows by now that one day he will know why he has suffered unjustly. We have seen this from what he reveals. Job reveals, as prophets reveal. Two things we have seen, two primary things Job reveals to us and to his generation. First of all, Job knows that his Redeemer lives, doesn't he? Job knows that he has a Redeemer, a Goel, and that this Redeemer lives. Job's suffering has driven him to this redemptive conclusion. Not just purely logic, not just purely reason has driven. God indeed has revealed this to him. But as he reveals it to him, it becomes reasonable, doesn't it? Job knows that his Redeemer lives. He struggles through this with two apparent contradictions. Two apparent contradictions that his friends resolve in completely traditional and conventional ways. First of all, God is just and punishes the wicked and rewards the righteous. That's the principle of Lex Talionis. God is just. Job asserts this too. So do his friends, but they come to different conclusions with the other point that lies in contradiction. God is just, and he punishes the wicked and rewards the righteous. But what comes in contradiction to this is Job says, I'm being punished as if I were one of the great wicked, yet I am blameless and upright. This completely contradicts the principle of Lex Talionis. His friends say, Job, duh, this is easy. You're being punished as one who's wicked, so you must be wicked. That's their whole driving point all the way through the book of Job. Job says, I'm blameless and upright. I maintain my integrity. I know it to my toenails. So there must be another answer, another solution. And God reveals it to him. Holding both of these as absolutely true, Job is driven to new heights of revelation through his suffering, concluding that only a redeemer, an intercessor, a mediator can intercede for him with an audience before God where he can take his complaint. Job, of course, many times saying, I'm incapable of standing before him in myself. I must have a, so consequently, there must be a redeemer, an intercessor, a mediator. We've seen this multiple times, how Job has struggled. He didn't do it early. It came late, right? And the second truth that we have arrived at, as Job gains wisdom from suffering. Job knows from his suffering that he will be resurrected in his own flesh. Right? That great, eloquent, high point of Job in chapter 19. Job knows that he will be resurrected in his own flesh, where he will be recompensed for his suffering, where he will be acquitted as just, and where he will have, finally, the purpose and reason for his suffering revealed. Once again, this is something that is revealed to him. He's a prophet. Job is driven to this conclusion of a resurrection of the dead precisely because it is only just, and God is just, it is only just that he be recompensed and acquitted in the flesh. If he experiences all this suffering in the flesh, then God is just, and he will raise my body though I die, and I will be recompensed. I will be acquitted in the flesh as well, since I have suffered in the same. So he boldly reveals to us the resurrection of the body. Well, behold the elements of the gospel. I want you to keep this in mind. We are in the patriarchal period, that long millennial-long period of the patriarchs between Noah and Abraham. But we have elements of the gospel there, available to the patriarchs. Why do you think Abraham knew that God would raise Isaac from the dead? Right? Hebrews asserts that very clearly. He knew that if he slew his son, God would raise him from the dead. Where do you think he got that notion? Thin air? No, he was reading Job. Noah feared Yahweh. Abraham feared Yahweh and had increasing elements of the gospel. I submit to you, Job feared God and had revealed to us elements of the gospel we have in the New Testament, for that matter, if you will. Behold, not the gospel of Job, but the gospel in Job this day. Well, let us now come to that place where we see the elements of the gospel so eloquently displayed to us in the body and blood of the Lord Jesus Christ, in the bread and wine of the supper of the Lord.